and welcome to Bible Talk. I'm your host, Zai Mazza, and today's episode is called The First Great King, because that's what this episode's about. For those of you that don't know, the first great king, according to the Bible, is actually a man named Nimrod. And for many of us, I think we view the term Nimrod as a pejorative. Now, I always thought that Nimrod was used as a pejorative because, you know, he was an idiot, he tried to go against God. Another story that I heard was that he's not a particularly great hunter and only became king due to the snakeskin coat he got from Noah. And we'll talk more about that later on in this episode. But what's actually very interesting, to me anyway, is apparently the origin of the term Nimrod used as a pejorative comes from Bugs Bunny. When Bugs Bunny sarcastically called Elmer Fudd Nimrod, and no one really in the audience of children got the joke, and it stuck as a pejorative, you know, to mean moron. The reason why that was, you know, a funny sarcastic remark is that the Bible in Genesis describes Nimrod as, quote, a mighty hunter before the Lord. He's a great hunter. In most of the Haggadah, that is Jewish folklore, he rose to become the great king of men because he was, you know, such a talented hunter, such a mighty hunter. So the story of Nimrod begins, you know, sometime after the flood, according to Haggadah, in the lifetime of Noah. He was Noah's great-grandson, and his kingdom was Babel, and that's the story of the famous Tower of Babel, comes from that. And he also owned, you know, had control over other cities. We see in the Bible he had control over Erech, Akkad, Calneh, the land of Shinar, and, you know, his lineage, you know, was great. And he's been likened, you know, they say that this is the ostensible beginning of the kingdom of Babylon. And a lot of contemporary studies of the Bible have tried to basically find comparisons between Nimrod and other Babylonian kings. And there's no real consensus there if Nimrod was ever a real person. But what is known is that he's the first, you know, great king, the first big figure after the Antediluvian period. In the lifetime of Nimrod, the, you know, big patriarchs of the Jewish faith and foundation of the Abrahamic religions overall, both Islam and Christianity, as well as Judaism, begin. So you have Abraham in the lifetime of Nimrod. Abraham, of course, gives birth to Isaac, who gives birth, or Abraham doesn't give birth to Isaac, but Abraham is the father of Isaac, and from Isaac comes Jacob and Esau. According to some legends, like the Book of Jasher, which is another apocryphal book, according to the Book of Jasher, it's Esau who kills Nimrod. Nimrod dies by Esau's sword because Esau is also a very formidable hunter. In some Jewish Haggadah, what actually happens is Esau and Nimrod are, you know, they have a hunting competition, and Nimrod has that snakeskin coat that I told you about. So recall from, you know, the episode about creation that I did, I said that according to legend, God gave Adam and Eve each a snakeskin coat that would allow them to basically preside over all animals. All animals would heed what they do, heed what they say. And I said, according to legend, Eve's snakeskin coat got lost, but Adam's found its way to Noah, which according to some legends is how he was able to, you know, organize the ark and whatnot. And Noah, according to legend, passed that on to Nimrod. Nimrod wasn't a particularly great hunter before he got the coat, but he gets the coat. These great beasts come up to him. He can just strike them down. According to legend, the first battle that he fought, because, you know, people were afraid of some invading force, he basically busted out the coat. They're like, Nimrod, save us. And Nimrod just brought an army of animals to stampede them. So Esau somehow manages to out-hunt Nimrod, and Nimrod's like, oh, they make a bet. Nimrod's like, oh, I'll give you anything you want, up to half of my kingdom. Esau somehow knew the power of Nimrod's coat, asked for the coat instead of half of the kingdom. That trope of, I'll give you anything I want, up to half of my kingdom, is pretty common in the Bible and Haggadah. But yeah, so Esau gets the coat that way. And another legend, Esau just straight up kills Nimrod. And that's, again, according to the Book of Asher. So Nimrod lived, you know, for a long time through the lifetime of Abraham, through the lifetime of Isaac, and on to, you know, part of the lifetimes of Jacob and Esau. According to Islamic tradition, Abraham and Nimrod actually met. And in Islamic tradition, Abraham, you know, gets brought before Nimrod because Abraham's like, you know, I don't worship you, Nimrod. I don't worship any of your, you know, crazy idol gods or whatever. I worship, you know, the one true God. And Nimrod basically goes, you know, why do you do that? And Abraham says, well, my God, you know, has the power of life and death. So Nimrod brings two, you know, condemned people into the room, and he has one killed, and he releases the other one. And of course, the meaning there that he's trying to convey to Abraham is that he too has the power of life and death in his control. And Abraham says, yeah, but, you know, God makes the sun rise and set. And Nimrod's like, well, you got me there. But of course, it never happens like that. So Nimrod sentences Abraham to death, and Abraham's there with his brother. And Abraham, it's kind of a precursor to the Nebuchadnezzar, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego story, which we'll talk about. He basically throws Abraham into a furnace, but the flames become branches of like a forest or something. So Abraham walks out unscathed, and Nimrod is basically, you know, he's aghast, and he's like, he goes to Abraham's brother. He's like, what do you believe? And Abraham's brother, you know, just saw how Abraham, you know, survived the furnace. So Abraham's brother goes, I believe in the God of Abraham. And Nimrod throws him in the furnace, but he burns up and dies. And the moral of that story is ostensibly that, you know, you need to have genuine faith. It's not enough to just be like, oh, you know, I saw that miracle and, you know, I guess I'm with that team now. Whereas Abraham's faith, you know, for whatever reason, was genuine. So that's according to Islamic tradition, a little run-in between King Nimrod and Abraham. So the area of land that Nimrod presided over, there's, you know, sayings about it. There have been four kings to preside over that land, and it's basically all of Judah and Israel and, you know, most of, you know, parts of Babylon and everything, but mostly the great kingdom, the big kingdom of Judah and Israel. Four people have presided over it. Two of them were, you know, believers and considered to be kind and just, and two of them were not. Two of them were considered to be evil men. The two evil men are Nimrod and King Nebuchadnezzar II, and we talked about him in the first episode, why he was just so formative in Judaism. And then the two that didn't, that were believers, who weren't evil, were David and Solomon. And other than that, there's never been a single person to preside over all that kingdom. So Nimrod was the first. Nimrod is the first great king of the Bible. So what does he do with it? Well, he decides, he gets it through his head that he wants to be God. So he builds the Tower of Babel. And the Bible, you know, doesn't really tell us that much about it. It just says, you know, they were building a tower, and God said, let us confound their languages. That's, again, another use of the us, because in the Hebrew, the noun they're using is Elohim, which is a plural noun. The question is, though, you know, is that a pantheon again? I don't know. Some people think that it seems to be. But yeah, so Nimrod's like, yeah, I'm going to build this tower. He wanted to reach the heavens. Now, according to Haggadah, which again isn't in the Bible, but it's just Jewish folklore, he's pretty interesting stuff. So he wants to build the tower up to the heavens. And he's like, all right, guys, let's do this. And everyone's like, yeah, like, I'm down. We're going to storm the heavens. You know, we'll be as gods. And he gets pretty close. And along the way, he keeps having archers fire arrows up into the heavens. And for the longest period of time, nothing happens. They just go up and they fall back down. But eventually, they get high enough and they start firing arrows at the heavens again. And they come back tipped with blood. And Nimrod's like, look at that. Like, we're killing angels. Like, shit, that's awesome. But apparently what God was doing is he was warning them by tipping the arrows in blood and sending them back. Like, you know, this isn't going to end well for you. But let's be honest. He could have chosen literally any other warning than that, and it would have been more effective. Like, literally little notes that are like, you shouldn't be doing this. Because that's like, I've never heard of more mixed signals than that. So I can kind of see where Nimrod was coming from, thinking that he was going to be successful. So yeah, the way the story goes is before that time, everyone spoke one language. And according to John Dee, who was Queen Elizabeth the First's basically court magician, court scryer, whatever, that language was what he called Enochian, the language of the angels. And that's the word, that's the language with which God said, let there be light, blah, 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 all of that. It's called Enochian because John Dee claimed, aside from himself, the last human to speak true Enochian was the biblical patriarch Enoch. So, you know, it was Adam and Eve, and then they developed some sort of proto-Hebrew, and then most people, I guess, were bilingual up until that point, Enochian and this proto-Hebrew. And then Enochian sort of faded away after Enoch, and that came to be this Hebrew that everyone was speaking at the time, which, according to this story, was basically the birth of all languages. And then God goes, boom, confounds the tongue. Everyone speaks different languages now. No one knows Enochian. You know, some people still speak Hebrew, but it's a different Hebrew than the kind of Hebrew that everyone was speaking, and no one can communicate with each other anymore. And they basically abandon the project because everyone, you know, is working for different reasons. Everyone, you know, they don't understand each other. They really just can't work together. So this confounding of the tongues happens, and everyone, you know, is good. Or not good, you know, however you want to believe it. And it's actually, you know, a pretty interesting thing to note. This whole notion that there is a true language, you know, an innate language, is pretty old, and it used to be the prevailing scientific wisdom. In fact, before the time of John Dee, you know, the Elizabethan era, there were plenty of language deprivation experiments done by either scientists or kings or whatnot to kind of figure out what that innate language was, either for the purpose of figuring out, you know, who the first nation or race was to, you know, try and create some sort of racial superiority thing, or to figure out what that language of creation was because they thought it held power. It's just John Dee was the first person to propose that that language was some language that we've never heard of before. So in Egypt, the Egyptian pharaoh, Psamtik, I don't know how to pronounce Egyptian pharaoh names, but yeah, he allegedly carried out an experiment where he gave a kid to a shepherd, because he wanted to figure out what the earliest race was. So he gave, and he was hoping for the answer to be Egyptians. So he gave a child to a shepherd, and he told the shepherd, you know, rear the child, care for it, nurture it, but don't ever speak to it. And the first word that this child said was Bekos, allegedly. He just blurted it out, which is the Phrygian word for bread. So this pharaoh concluded, contrary to the results he wanted, that Egyptians were not the earliest race, but in fact, Phrygians. Later on, in the Holy Roman Empire, and now I'm forgetting his name, but the emperor at the time tried to raise a bunch of infants at the same time without any sort of interaction to determine, you know, what the natural language was. He wasn't trying necessarily to see who, you know, the greatest race was or anything, or the earliest race. He was just trying to see the language that would have been imparted to Adam and Eve by God, the language that they used. He thought that something would be, you know, unique to them. And those results were, I think the children died or something. It turns out children need interaction, basically, to survive. It's very bad for them. Also, there was some, I think the church was involved with that experiment. And there was some monk who presided over it. And then later on, in Scotland, I'm also forgetting the king's name. I think it was King James the somethingeth. He had, you know, some children to go be reared on an island, and according to claims, they started speaking Hebrew. But no one buys that. No one buys that at all. But yeah, according to what he claimed, that they just, you know, learned perfect Hebrew. And then someone else, basically, it was either an Ottoman or some Islamic emperor, and he repeated the experiment, And he determined that speech arose from hearing, basically the first one to figure that out, and that children raised without hearing human speech, hearing anyone talk at all, would never talk again, or would never talk ever. So that's kind of, but all of these experiments sort of came from this story of Babel. People wanted to figure out what the earliest language was. That's pretty interesting, because that's some of the earliest scientific inquiry that we have is, you know, we have these people way back in ancient Egypt trying to figure things out. Now, all of these experiments, you know, were obviously pretty flawed by today's scientific rigor, but, you know, you can still see where they were coming from and, you know, what they were trying to accomplish. So, yeah, that's the lifetime of Nimrod and his legacy. And next time we're going to talk about the lifetime of Abraham and his legacy, which was great, because we all know that Father Abraham had many sons. And many sons also had Father Abraham. Jews are one of them, and so are Christians, but also so are Muslims. So that's what we're going to talk about next time. And then we're going to wrap up Genesis any day now. So thanks for listening, and have a great day. Bye-bye.